Hello and welcome to Democracy in Action. Today, my name is Lucy Kiden. Now, today's episode will focus on the role of security forces in our democratic political system. Security is a fundamental element in any organized society. A clear understanding on the roles of security organs empowered to ensure security in the society is important for both security personnel and the civil population. So joining me to discuss this in detail is Christine Forsen, who is UNMISS Police Commissioner, and we also have Christina Rossati, who is a Department of Rule of Law and Security Institution Sector as Senior Security Sector Reform Officer. We do expect to have a third guest, and I will definitely introduce her once she comes in. Well, Christine and Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be
Very
here.
Similar names there. Thank you for coming. And so first off, I would like us to just look at the key words in the topic. We have security, we have security organs or forces, and then we have the democratic political system. So looking at this, what are these and how do they come together? Yes. Okay. Yes, Christina.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us here. I think let me start by saying the security is usually the responsibility for the police, and security forces are usually consisting of it's depending on the national setup. For example, for South Sudan, the security forces are composed by the military and the National Police Service and the National Security Service. But in many democratic countries, the security forces typically consist of several branches, which they can be individually responsible for different security areas. Mm-hmm. But I think that the security overall is the state responsibility, and then they divide the security responsibility within their institutions. But let me leave it a little bit to Christina to explain a little bit more how you connect this to the governance of the country.
Thank you very much. Yes, what I would say is that, you know, we have in the United Nations, we are familiar with the systems of a wide range of countries, and countries manage security differently according to also their needs. And what we generally would say is that one of the important things are the principles. The principles in this case are the idea that what are the functions of the security that need to be undertaken in the country. So when you start with what are the security functions that need to be performed, different countries find different solutions to that.
Yes.
So there are some countries that decided not to have a military, for example, because they realized they don't need it. There are some countries who give their certain kinds of functions to, you know, the police or others, to other entities that they create. What is most important in terms of linking this to the democratic system is that all of these security organs operate within a rule of law framework. What that means is that as we like to say that no person is above the law, the security organs also should operate within the system of rule of law according to the laws that are of that country. And we can talk about that in more detail.
Yes, but definitely.
That's the most important aspect.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for explaining that. And just right now, our third guest has joined us, and this is from CITISAM. She is a board member, and this is Sarah Nyanath. You're very welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
Yes. So these three ladies are experts, and we're here to discuss the role of security forces in democracy, in a democratic political system. And we've just looked at the fact that it's the state that's responsible, and then they are able to distribute the roles and create the organ that will be in charge of ensuring security. And this security personnel will have to work under the rule of law. They're regulated by the rule of law, and we'll be going into more detail in that case. And earlier on, Christina, you did mention the different bodies under the security forces. We have the military, the police, and the national security. I want us to briefly understand the key roles of each of these specific broken down bodies under security at a whole. So, Christina, you could go ahead and just break it down. Oh, so we have Christine and Christina. Okay, let me use your other names then. Christina Rossati, go ahead and just explain. What is the specific role for the military? What is the specific role for the police? And what is the specific role for the national security?
Thank you. I would say, to begin with, I would say, again, these are may vary country by country. But it is when we talk about the security sector, this is very much an issue for the people of the country to decide how they wish these organs to work. And I can say, generally speaking, what the difference, one of the most important things before we get into the things that they usually do, one of the most important things is that these are, again, specified in law. Why is that important? Because if they are not specified and deconflicted in law, you will have multiple security organs stepping on top of each other, thinking that it's their job to do something, and they all believe that. And there is a lack of clarity. And in some countries, we have seen that can lead to clashes, even among, you know, a country's own security forces, because there is a lack of clarity on who should be doing what. Now, generally speaking, when we talk about the police, they are the ones usually in charge of enforcing laws, so criminal laws and these kinds of things, and they are the ones who are best placed to engage the most with the population directly. That is because, as we know, militaries tend to have much higher order kind of operational tactical skills, and it's not suitable, which is suitable for maybe for war, but is not suitable to be in contact with the population. So in some, you know, contexts, we see that where there are overly militarized police, it is very damaging to the relationship with the communities, because communities need to be able to trust the police, and they need to feel that they can go to them. And in all cases, in these relationships among the communities and security actors, there needs to be mutual respect. And because militaries tend to have, bring with them stronger levels of force, generally speaking, those need to be reserved, not to engage directly with the population of the country itself, but reserved for higher order threats. Now, militaries also have very, very important peacetime roles, and that's also very important to consider. What is the role of a military in peacetime? So, for example, in a lot of contexts, that may mean training. If you are at a country at peace, you want to be able to take the time to take your military, which doesn't need to be fighting anyone, to be able to train, to bring their skills, to make them, you know, even more professional, and to use that time wisely that you have.
Yes.
And also to perform certain kinds of emergency actions in a country when requested by civilian authorities. So that may relate to natural disasters, earthquakes, as we see. It can be flooding. It can be any type of natural disaster where the logistical and operational capabilities of a military may be very useful, but that has to be very well coordinated with civilian authorities.
Okay. And when you talk about national security...
So national security generally sometimes refers to intelligence services. They also have a very important role to play. But again, that is very important to be codified in law. It is very important also that intelligence services, their role is very clearly understood, and the limits of their role is also very clear. And in all the security organs, accountability is very important. And when we talk about accountability, I would say there are, you know, roughly three layers. One is internal accountability. So we're talking about, you know, within an organization, the kinds of steps we take within our own organizations to hold people accountable for proper conduct and professionalism. The next level is sort of governmental bodies tasked with oversight. So in this case, it refers to, for example, parliamentary type oversight of security organs. organs. And then the general level is then also the population at large. In what ways are they able to, in what ways are security organs accountable to the people of the country?
Okay, and we'll get more details in terms of the accountability later. You did mention the bit about the legislation, the laws that are governing security forces, and why it's very important for these different organs to adhere to the laws, because then the law defines their roles. Now, can we speak into South Sudan? What is the current what are the current laws that govern the security forces in South Sudan, and how is the, you know, the assessment of how they function in South Sudan? Yes, Ms. Wilson.
Well, it's important that the constitution is not it's governing the whole structure of the government security forces, but I'm not too aware of the internal. They have a code of police act, mm-hmm. which is governing the police, and this is the guiding principle for the police to follow. Otherwise, they have institutional directives and policies and procedural guidelines. But I think I will leave it to Christina, who's the security sector reform advisor,
yes.
because this is one of the roles we have as a peacekeeping mission here, is to guide the government in what laws must be in place, how do you fill up with guidelines and principles, and how do you make this whole security sector work as it should to international standards and international guiding principles. And because South Sudan is the world's youngest country, so that's why we're here to support and to guide the government. The whole mission is doing this. So I think I will leave it to Christina to be more specific.
Okay. Christina, do get into the details, and I'll be coming to you shortly, Sarah, after this.
I think we could have a whole program on that,
yeah.
and I can suggest it. I think that, as the police commissioner mentioned, the constitution, so South Sudan right now has a transitional constitution, as amended 2011, and we know that there are discussions ongoing about the permanent constitution-making process. So the constitution is very, very important, because, in fact, when we talk about forces being, all types of security forces, being apolitical. What does that mean? It means that security forces are not there to support a particular subset of any type of population within a country. They are there really to support the country as a whole. So that means, you know, different political parties, it means different, you know, cultural groupings, identity groups, everyone, marginalized people, vulnerable people. Really, when you become a member of the security forces, it is, you know, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but I do think it is very much a higher calling. You really have to take your responsibilities towards the people very, very seriously. So the Constitution is the document that provides that you seek to uphold as a member of, that you are protecting as a member of the security forces and adhering to. Subsequently to that, there may be any number of laws that will govern independent entities related. So if the Constitution specified certain configurations of security forces, each of those entities may have specific laws pertaining to it. And on top of this, there are also what are known as sort of budgeting laws, or the linkage when laws are passed for budgets that may include legal provisions. So, for example, in some countries, these are combined into one document where the budget for the security forces is outlined, but also certain legal requirements are also outlined in the same document. In other countries, those may be two separate documents, but they are both equally important because just to mention that law is never finished. Law is constantly, you know, undergoing either potentially processes of revision. And when we talk about security sector reform or transformation, one of the reasons we talk about this as an ongoing process is because security environments change. So I'll give you an example. I worked in my prior work on the issue of piracy off the coast of Somalia. And when piracy off the coast of Somalia became a big issue, many countries had already gotten rid of the piracy laws in their legal systems because they thought it was something from 100, 200 years ago. They didn't think it was relevant anymore. And suddenly, when they were confronted with this, they had to pass new laws to be able for them to be able to take action to counter piracy, which they had thought was something no longer they had to worry about. So it's a living, the law is a living response to a changing security environment.
Okay. And just given the current context, what are the ones that are there and which ones probably need to be available to effectively ensure that security organs are performing their duties as required? So we do have the Police Act that Christine did mention earlier. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I don't have the list now. If I wouldn't do justice to it because I wouldn't want to leave out
some of them.
But one of the things I can say is that in connection with the law, and I know it's been a bit challenging, a best practice certainly for countries is to make sure that all of the laws are publicly available. So that can be the easiest way now is to put them online. Why is this important? First of all, it's important because if you wish people to follow the law, they must be able to access what the laws are. And in the best scenarios that I've seen, you are able, parliaments also, for example, are able to put up the draft bills, then they put up the bills that are being considered, then the bills that have been passed, then the bills that have been enacted into law, essentially. Because it's a process. So one of the things I would say is that in some cases we ourselves are not always sure what where certain laws are in the South Sudanese context. So I do think that that is something that can be very helpful.
Okay. Christine, you did want to add something.
No, I just wanted to make a quick comment on it. What Christina just briefly mentioned, which is really important, is that all security forces, and especially the police, they need legal framework for every single action they are going to take. And as Christina mentioned, the public has to know what is legal, legally can do or not. And secondly, the police officers need to know what is the framework and we're operating within. And that's a responsibility that lays with the top leaders and at the end of the day at the Minister of Interior and the President. But they have to make sure that the legal framework is in place. So if of course you can delegate some authority to the IGP, to the Inspector General of the Police, and so forth. But you can make provisions, you can make guidelines, but you have to have everything has to be amended accordingly to the legal framework. And then Christine has explained the process, but
okay.
This is important.
Thank you very much. And coming to you now, Sarah, you've been quiet. Thank you for joining us in this discussion. Sarah here is a board member of CITISAM, which is the Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangements Monitoring and Verification Mechanism. Do you have something to add in terms of the laws in place and what needs to be added and the importance?
Well, I would say that based on the provision within the Constitution, which then provide for the security forces and the subsidiary security law enforcement bodies, which include the police, the fire brigade, the wildlife, and the police, the fire brigade, the wildlife, and the national security beside the army itself, because this has been provided under the Article 159 in the Transitional Constitution as amended 2011. With this, when our country, elapsed and went through all the unnecessary violence, the Chapter 2 of the Agreement of the Arses recognized, the challenges that are there. And Chapter 2 actually provided that all the forces, whether the army or the law enforcement body, including the security, has to go through a security transformation. And this transformation started with the issues of providing a framework which then would inform the laws. Of course, the Constitution enshrine I mean, the transitional constitution enshrine the provision of these institutions why they are to be established, but then for them to be transformed, because as you know, the history of our country, we do not have, you know, the quality of the army, the quality of the police, as the citizen expected or as provided by the mandate of the constitution. So this would mean we're going through the laws again. Laws has to be revised, and it has been provided within the agreement, so that at least the laws that govern these institutions, they uphold to the international standards and what has been provided, and especially principle of democratic system, a federal democratic system as provided by our constitution. This is still, as we all know, the process is still ongoing. You could imagine the training, the unification, the framework itself, and the white paper has not yet been out. This is provided in Article 2.5 of the ARCIS, which is in Chapter 2. And the role of CITESAM, of course, is to monitor, verify, and report on the adherence of some of these implementations. So, yeah, basically, there is the whole review that all these laws has to go through, not particular one that has been proven that this law, whether be it the National Security Act or the Police Act, National Police Act, has been said it is okay, it could go continue like this. No, all the law has to be reviewed. What has to be reaffirmed that it is okay has to be, whatever part is to be reaffirmed has to be reaffirmed by the constitution. Okay. By those that are involved, yes.
Yes, thank you very much. If you've just joined us, this is Democracy in Action, and today we are looking at the role of security forces in a democratic political system. And with me is Christine Fossen, who is a police commissioner here at ANMIS. We have Christina Rossati, who is the ANMIS who is part of the ANMIS in the Rule of Law and Security Institution section as Senior Security Sector Reform Officer. And we have Sarah Nyanath, who's a board member of CITESAM, a monitoring body for the security area in South Sudan. And we've looked at a lot for the past about 30 minutes. We've been looking at the importance of having a functional security sector in a country like South Sudan. And just as Sarah mentioned, there is need for reform. And earlier, Christine did mention that the security organs need to function under the rule of law. And so there's need for a legal framework that guides the different functions of the different bodies in the security sector, where we have the military or the army, we have the police, and then we have the national security. And right now, what's ongoing is, as directed by the revitalized peace agreement, there needs to be a turnover, you know, a look at what are the current laws, what needs to be amended. Every single act that is there needs to be, there needs to be a transformation, because what is there is not the right quality. I'm quoting Sarah here. The quality is not what is expected by the public. And so, yes, so that is what is going on. And so if you have a question, if you have a comment, you can actually send your question in on our SMS line, 0912-177-141. Go ahead and do that as we continue with the discussion after the break. Stay tuned.
101 FM. About the nation, across the nation. Radio Miraya.
Well, welcome back, and we are We are here going on with Democracy in Action. It's just 20 minutes to the top of the hour. And shortly, we'll have lines open for you to ask your questions. But for now, do send your questions to 0912177141. We are looking at the role of security organs, with the role of security forces in a democratic political system. And so we've understood that it's very, very important for laws to be in place, but what are the general guiding principles that are constant in this regard? The laws can vary from country to country, society to society, but then what are the overall guiding principles? Yes, go ahead, Christina.
Thank you. I'll start. I'm sure I would like to hear everyone's thoughts on this. But I think, you know, from our perspective, it's very much centered on, the principles are centered on the protection of rights. Now, those rights generally are contained in legal documents like the Constitution. These are, if you look at the transitional Constitution, there is a section outlining the rights of the people of South Sudan. And the security forces essentially are there to protect the people and their rights. Now, those can be different kinds of rights. You know, sometimes we talk about the right to your own life, the right to be safe and secure in your person, your community. And then there are things called, you know, social, civic and political rights, and also economic rights. From a very also practical perspective, I just want to highlight also that implicit in this is that by these protective actions, so again, these are protective defensive, they are not generally aggressive or offensive actions. So they are, you are seeking to prevent violence, you're seeking to prevent injuries of different types. What the positive result of this, when it is successful, is that you create an enabling environment. I like to say that security is not a goal in itself. It is really, what does security give you? And security gives you the ability to pursue economic development, to raise living standards, to be able to pursue education, to be able to pursue the development of your country, to be able to, you know, create wonderful cultural expression, to basically be able to enjoy life, to be able to enjoy your country. When people are afraid or always at risk, or, you know, living in very precarious circumstances because of a dangerous security environment, it has all sorts of adverse consequences. As one example, if you are so insecure that you cannot farm, it has an effect on the whole economy. So this is where security, I think, we talk about the principles. Why are these principles of protection of people's rights so important? Is because of what it enables for the country, enable its own advancement.
And if I can just continue,
yes,
on this, because the role of the police is that they're responsible for law and order and enforcement of the laws and investigation of crimes, prevent and respond to incidents, and also to ensure the public safety. I'm referring to the last example about farming, because if people are going to farm, and if they're prevented from farming because of cattle raiding or other incidents that take place because people make it insecure to farm, we are here, we're trying to discuss how can we support the local police and the communities to understand the importance of living in peace and harmony. And if you have conflicts with each other, don't fight each other or kill each other, but try to solve the problems you have either through the police and a proper investigation, and let law come through, let the public prosecution take place, or you can solve some of the issues can be solved within the community, but then you have to have trust. So we're working a lot on the community policing aspect to build trust within the community, to work with the police, and to solve also problems without escalating it.
Okay, thank you very much, Christina. And Christina, for that, do you have something to add, Sarah?
Well, the little that I just wanted to add what Christine has said is that for sure the guiding principle is that we have to uphold to constitutionalism, because without upholding to what it has provided, then even this institution ceases to exist. Yeah, it is the establishment, and we have to respect the constitution. And because we are, for example, South Sudanese, we are 64 tribes. If we can uphold to a guiding principle of the constitution to protect and defend the constitution, which is then what is the role of the security and law enforcement body, is to defend and protect. So those rights and freedom of of expression, of movement, if we can protect those principles, you know, we can uphold to those principles, then we cease to exist as a nation. Then we become lawless, you know.
So, all right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yes, very briefly,
yeah,
Christine.
I just want to also, because I think this is so interesting by South Sudan and working here and trying to do what we're doing from UNMIS side, is the ethnic and the cultural aspects. And this is what we are trying to discuss with at least I do with the National Police Services, that cattle raiding is a crime. And the same is sexual gender-based violence is a crime and should be addressed in the proper way. And you cannot discuss it as it's a cultural aspect or it's a this is the way we do it. But it's a balance. Sometimes you have to respect the local ethnic code of conduct. On the other hand, you need to define what is right, what is wrong,
yes,
and where do the laws apply.
And that falls under the general principles,
yes,
because it looks into the rights of a human being, of a person,
right,
and also, yeah, and that needs to be protected, and that is one key role for the security forces. And also, you talked about, you did mention property, I believe, in terms of the general mandate for the security forces. And so right now I want us to delve into the bit about who assigns this responsibility to the security forces. And Christine, this goes to you. Who should appoint the leadership of the army, the police commissioners, and the leadership positions of security forces?
Well, the appointment of these leadership positions is usually done by the, it's in the legal framework and it should be addressed in the constitution. But it also differs from each country and on how the national setup and arrangements are. But it's normally the president of the republic or other, in Norway it's the king who appoints at the end of the day, but everything is prepared through the government system. But at the end of the day it should be the top president or the king or whoever is the head of the state who appoints and delegates the authority. But the most important thing is that should be a board, it should be a transparency, it should be, the positions should be announced, or at least they should be discussed through a board, and it should be transparency for all the selection process, so you can see who's appointed. And then you should also seek, there should of course be competences, especially for the police, you should have competences in place, and you should also look into the gender equality.
Okay, thank you for that. And in a democratic society, we do have the key organs, which is the executive, then we have the legislature, as well as the judiciary. Where does security come in, and how can the different organs collaborate to ensure effective performance of their duties?
Let me add on what Christine has mentioned earlier. All these security head of institutions, by law, the president has been mandated to appoint the directors. But before he does the appointment, the concerned minister normally propose and suggest to the Council of Ministers. And once the Council of Ministers approve, for example, a director of police service or wildlife, then the president now appoints. So this is what the constitution provides. Coming to these other questions about the role of legislature.
Yes.
Yeah. come again.
Yes, how do they work together with the security, the organs of the country? So you have legislature, judiciary, and the executive. So we see that the executive appoints and distributes the roles, but then how do they work together to ensure effective management and collaboration?
Well, the security sector and law enforcement body fall under the executive. By the constitution, they fall under the executive. So the relationship that links in that label as the legislature link with the legislature, because basically the legislature, they are there to legislate. Okay, the executive can propose, and then it is up to the legislature to cross-check this proposal. If it goes along one, you know, is in line with one of the provision within the constitution. And of course, the judiciary, are there like for checks and balance? Are they, these two others in institution, are they in line? If there is any conflict, then this is where they come in. So basically, the security sector, they comes in to reinforce what has been provided, but under the executive.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. And as we continue, we do have some questions that are coming in, and I'll be distributing them shortly. However, our time is first spent, and I want us to touch briefly on the gender parity. Why is it important to promote gender parity in security forces in terms of equality and, of course, the 50-50 that we want to achieve by 2030? Yes.
Let me start. Firstly, it's important because the world consists of men and women, and it should be, it is simple as that. That in South Sudan, you have more than 50% women, I'm told. And it of course, the women should be presented in the government positions, and as in all countries, because we are equal. So that's a general principle. That's why gender parity is important. And also, it brings to the table different aspects. But here in South Sudan, we, from at least from when it comes to the police and the security forces, we have no formal statistics on the gender parity. We have asked for numbers, and we really don't have the full picture of how they are in numbers. But we do. From the UNMISS side and from the whole UN family, the international community, we do support the government in many, many ways, taking actions so we can strive to support them for gender mainstreaming. And we have encouraged, and all the security forces have established gender focal points in their departments and operations. And we see from the police side that the security forces have established a female network, which has been very good in discussing together with the police officers and the military officers who are females, discussing common interests and common concerns they have. And we are trying to support them with different activities like capacity building. We have established, as I mentioned, the security sector networks. We are advocating constantly for better conducive working environment. Mm-hmm. We are constantly also addressing the need to work on the sexual gender-based violence. And at least now we are, from the UNMISS side, we are now in May hopefully rolling out a training program for female police officers. We're starting here in Juba, where we will train them to give them skill set and competences, which hopefully will be enable them to further on seek higher positions. This has also been discussed with the National Police Service, and I'm hoping that the Inspector General of the Police will see the outcome of this training, which will be for 8 weeks. And so hopefully this will do something for the female police officers on the mid-level, so we can push some of them to take higher positions.
All right. We are equal, and indeed we can all contribute to what security sector has to offer for the country. Thank you for that, Christine. Now, as we are concluding, there's a question here. This is from Robert Akech Dude from Awil, South County, Northern Bargazal State. And he says, why is the formation of Security Council always not stable? And in this case, I'm not sure what exactly he means by not stable, but I'm looking at the fact that there's probably a mix-up in terms of roles. And Sarah, would you like to take that?
Well, under the, I think, in our constitution, the Security Council is provided under the Security Council and Security Committee. It is provided within the transitional Constitution 2011 as amended, Article 160. This way it has been provided. And the security, the composition of this body is yet to be also determined by law. I haven't read whether that law is available or not, but it has been provided by the Constitution. And normally this council is composed of the different parties and, you know, the stakeholders. So it's not just like one body, one solid one body. And I believe the factor of political will in our country, it is at play. Sometimes I think, you know, as the English say, that action speaks louder than the words.
Than words, yes.
And I think some of the things we do not need to go into detail, because we can see practically why even the security sector reform or unification of forces is still at a stage. Is because some of this, because this is like the highest organ where, you know, principals are part of this Security Council and committees.
Yes.
Which is the council at the national level and committee at the state level as you continue to go down. And, you know, this decision makers' interest, if they are in conflict and they are not harmonized, then you would
then
see
it affects,
the outcome.
It
the
affects
outcome,
the
yes.
stability. Mm.
So you reap what you plant.
Okay.
You need it,
yeah. So the fact that there's still the political sort of divide in terms of in the security sector, of which the security sector is supposed to be independent of any political affiliation, and so that is affecting the stability. This is a very deep conversation, and I feel there's a lot to delve into.
Yeah, and other thing is that
yes,
since also we do not have the framework in place to guide this very body as well, is still another factor as well.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for explaining this. And now we understand that without a proper, clear legal framework that is approved and stamped, the security sector is still imbalanced and there's a lot that needs to be done. And that is very good. Thank you for sharing all your knowledge and wisdom on this topic. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.